It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Pundits are already calling 2013 the least productive year in congressional history. Even if Congress accomplishes everything on its to-do list before the end of the year, this Congress will be remembered more for what it didn't get done.
So how did we get here? Where does this inaction come from? Our guest this half hour says the trend has developed partly because of party polarization, and he's here to talk about how that has developed over time. Jonathan Pollack is with us. He is a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. And John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's talk about the idea of the least productive year in congressional history. You know, in the history of the Republic, that's pretty big talk. Is it true?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly down there in the least productive years. I think, you know, there are always kind of phases of kind of a gridlock in Congress. When you've got divided government, when you've got the president who's a member of one party, or you have the Senate under, as we have this in this session, Democratic control, and the House under Republican control. So that's a fairly consistent thing. There have been other periods of gridlock. But what I think makes this Congress different and is a real sea change in American politics in the 21st century over earlier periods of time is the degree of party unity. That this was something, you know, when I started my teaching career about 20 years ago, I used to tell my students that really in American politics, there's more difference within each party than between them. That ultimately there was sort of a middle ground between the Democrats and Republicans that presidential candidates ran toward, and that leaders of both parties in Congress kind of staked out that position to bring things together and get legislation passed. And what we've seen, especially in the last 20 years or so, and really accelerated since about 2009, is a real kind of unity among each party, that it used to be there were different flavors of Democrat or different flavors of Republican depending on where you were in the United States, and that both parties had their liberal and conservative wings. And we've moved to a much more unified kind of party where to be a Democrat in Wisconsin is pretty much what it's like to be a Democrat in Florida or Washington State, and to be a Republican in Wisconsin is like being a Republican in Georgia or a Republican in Arizona. And so with the lack of diversity within each party, the natural result is the people who would gravitate toward the middle, who would broker compromises, who would try to get legislation passed, that's just not happening.
So any idea why this occurred? I mean, because it seems like you were saying that, you know, years past, a lot of the debate we saw was within parties themselves on whatever the issue of the day was. Now, as you point out, it seems as though if you are a Democrat, you toe the party line. If you're a Republican, you toe the party line, or there's going to be trouble to pay for you as a member of that party down the line. Somebody will find somebody to run against you in a primary somewhere. So why do you think that happened? Is it an evolution in the party structure where it became politics is more all or nothing? Or it was just a natural sort of thing?
Well, I think there's kind of we can look from like a national level down and we can look from a state level up.
Mm-hmm.
So from a state level up, both parties have done in most states, because not all states have this, but in most states, you take the census and then the Congress that's elected like 2 years after, the state legislature that's elected 2 years after divides up how the districts work, and that's how we do things in Wisconsin. And the rise of big data, the rise of quantification, the ability to identify potential voters has enabled really both parties to create districts whereas people say the parties pick their voters instead of vice versa. So if you create relatively homogenous districts where it's very difficult, where you've got a heavily Republican district, a heavily Democratic district, where the races just aren't going to be competitive, where there's a very slim chance that that voters in that particular district are going to, you know, deviate from their party tradition, then what happens is all the action comes in the primary. And so in a Republican district, people compete to see who's like the most Republican, in a Democratic district, who's the most Democratic. And as a result, people who are, you know, who are kind of on the fence, who say, well, yeah, I agree with National Democrats most of the time, but I really disagree with this, or vice versa on the Republican side, they're the ones who get zoned out. They don't make it through the primary. So that's kind of the bottom-up version. And the top-down version I think is it's due to like the rise of 24-hour news cycles. That in a 24-hour news cycle, you're constantly looking for material to put on air. And, you know, in the limited experience I have actually like behind the microphone in journalism and sort of studying the history of journalism and so on, is that, you know, the bias in journalism is really toward action. You know, there's a bias toward action. Like stuff that's boring does not get broadcast. It does not get – certainly doesn't get aired on television. And stuff that's exciting does. And so if you want to build your career as a politician, you know, it's easier to do that. The idea of building a career as the person who behind the scenes brings people together quietly out of the spotlight on the QT, well, if it's secret, it's not getting on television. It's not getting the airtime. It's not getting the guest shots on Jon Stewart, or you're not getting on Sean Hannity or anything like that. You're just kind of like in the background. Whereas if you're fire breather, if you're the person who makes these, you know, big, bold statements before a friendly crowd, before an audience, you know, drummed up by a think tank that supports your ideological perspective, then that makes television. You know, if somebody's saying something outrageous and an audience of people cheering, you know, people will comment on that online. They'll stop what they're doing to take a look at it. So I think that's kind of the national picture trickling down, that you've got both those forces putting pressure on politicians to act a certain way to kind of depart from this idea of behind the scenes compromise and people saying, OK, we can agree to disagree on this. I'll take this. You take that. That's boring to look at. Negotiations are not as fun to watch as big blanket statements.
And compromise is not as interesting to write about if you're a reporter. One of the things that you point out is kind of a turning point in this whole idea of compromise becoming a dirty word happened at the 2009 State of the Union address. And we've got a clip here that we'd like to play from that. And so here's the deal. It's the 2009 State of the Union address. President Obama is giving it, and this is what we hear.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal. It's not true.
And there we go. Representative Joe Wilson there in the background. You lie is what he – why is this such an important moment in the history of all this?
Well, when I first ran across that clip, what it reminded me of was a show that my roommates and I watched occasionally in college late at night on C-SPAN.
Wow,
that's
you guys.
Kinda, yeah.
crazy college guys.
Pretty crazy stuff going on. It was a televised sessions of Parliament called Question Time, where it's a British custom where people can just ask the Prime Minister, members of Parliament ask the Prime Minister just really blunt questions. And it's this really kind of confrontational sort of questioning we didn't really have in the United States. I mean, if you watch like Senate proceedings and so forth, they're full of the, you know, my esteemed colleague, the junior senator from Colorado, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's couched in this very kind of elegant language. But Question Time is just super blunt. And I remember watching this and finding it kind of funny that, you know, they could just ask their prime minister that. And that ties into, the difference between the British government and ours. It's a parliamentary system. In a parliamentary system, the prime minister is the head of the party in the way that the president isn't traditionally in the United States. There's a chair of the Republican Party. There's a chair of the Democratic Party that aren't elected officials, that are party officials. But one of the effects of this polarization in American politics is it makes American parties more like political parties in parliamentary systems, where they've got a consistent and sort of narrower set of goals and ideas. And where that's kind of weird in the American system is that parliamentary democracies typically have at least three parties that get votes, that elect people to office in fairly large numbers. And in the U.S., of course, we have this really entrenched two-party system that has been very difficult for third parties to take off. There's even in these times, there's not really much of a serious momentum building for a third-party movement even now.
Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be taking some of your calls. We're talking to history expert Jonathan Pollack right now about the rise of political polarization in Congress in Wisconsin and throughout the nation.
We want to know what you think about this, too. What do you think is driving the political inaction and the partisanship that we're seeing today? What needs to change in order to stop some of the intense polarization statewide and across the nation? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking about the rise of political gridlock in Congress, Wisconsin, and nationwide with Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think is behind all of this? And what would you like to see changed? Are you optimistic that things can change? And how? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@WPR.org or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We've got some calls lined up. Before we go to those, though, Jonathan Pollack, one of the questions I wanted to ask was about the election of Barack Obama in 2008 and whether you think that that changed kind of the formula in terms of gridlock, because it seems as though it's been around for a while, but it also seems as though it took a turn for locking up a little more after that election.
Yeah, I think that that the gridlock has really increased since Obama came into office. And I think there are a few reasons. First of all, I think coming off of George W. Bush's two terms in office and his relative popularity and popularity for his wars and so forth while he was in office, I think there was a sense among Republicans in the United States that the Republican dynasty was pretty much sealed, that this was a done deal and really kind of had been since the age of Ronald Reagan. And that to have Obama come and also in the, you know, remember when Obama ran for president in 08, Hillary Clinton was the front runner early on. I mean, everyone knew, oh, it's going to be Hillary Clinton again. And Clinton, honestly, was, you know, he took a lot of plays out of the Republican playbook while he was president. A lot of people compared his policies to Richard Nixon's. So Hillary Clinton was like a candidate Republicans could sort of imagine. Obama seemed to come out of nowhere. And I think that was profoundly puzzling. And at the same time, on the Democratic side, lots of people voted for Obama who hadn't been engaged voters before, that Obama brought a lot of people into politics who had not thought of themselves as following politics especially closely, and they were huge fans. So this groundswell of voters who seemed to come out of nowhere and a candidate who wasn't as well known prompted Republicans to kind of, you know, retreat a little bit and try to figure out who he was.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got a call from Alex, who joins us from Stoughton. Hi, Alex.
Hi there. My question for the guest is, I would like for him to comment on some research that I ran across in school, saying that when the majority party is redistricting in a state, they actually tend not to put a supermajority of people, but just a simple majority of, you know, whether Republicans or Democrats, so that way they can include more of the other party and sort of eliminate their representation by having someone from, you know, the Republican or Democratic Party against them. So I was wondering if the guest could comment on that, if he's run across any similar research that says that, you know, just because you've redistricted doesn't mean that it's a done deal for a single party, because a lot of those, because of 51%, have switched over to other parties in elections following the redistricting. And then also, sort of my theory to sort of replace that, if it is false, is to say that people really just want these sort of angry, vitriolic candidates because they believe that they're going to fight for them when really all they're doing is fighting and they're not building consensus.
All right, Alex, thanks for the call. A couple of things there. Redistricting, of course. Man, that's been all over the place in Wisconsin lately.
Yeah, I mean, I think redistricting, there are definitely districts that wind up being roughly even or that have a slight majority and so forth. I mean, it varies depending on the individual state house, and it varies around the state. I mean, even with the quantitative tools that are available now to party officials and the attorneys who focus on election law, they can't guarantee landslides in every district. There are going to be some districts that wind up more or less even. But quite a few people do wind up kind of zoned into those, into districts that are going to go with a pretty solid majority of one party or another. Though I don't, you know, I'm not enough of a political scientist and a quantoid to say how many it is of each. On to the second point about voters wanting this kind of confrontational style. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I think that, you know, before we sit here and point fingers and say, oh, it's a horrible thing that politics is so divisive, and why don't candidates willing to compromise win? Gene, I think you had mentioned that a little bit in some of your comments earlier, that that it, you know, there's really no incentive to be that compromiser, that the impetus for that comes from, like, editorial page boards. It comes from talking heads on Sunday morning television, Sunday morning news programming. And outside of that, people might say, oh, yeah, we kind of want that sort of stable compromise consensus building sort of candidate. But actually, given like the excitement of an election season and being in a voting booth during a primary time, the compromise candidates look kind of milquetoast. And people say, like you said, Alex, we want somebody who's going to get in there and fight for us.
Are there ebbs and flows in American politics in terms of this kind of, you know, compromise, not compromise, that sort of thing? And could we argue that maybe we're just in one of those times right now and somehow the pendulum will swing back the other way?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. I'd say it's an especially intense swing in this direction at this moment. But, you know, if you look at moments of political realignment, you look at like after 1964, where the Civil Rights Act prompted many of the Southern Democrats to leave the Democratic Party and join the Republicans. And the kind of polarizing force of Barry Goldwater's campaign, that he was, you know, he knocked off Nelson Rockefeller in the primary, who was like a classic middle-of-the-road liberal Republican. And Goldwater's campaign initially, people said, oh, this is polarizing. It resulted in a terrible electoral loss for Goldwater. And yet the people who came up on the Goldwater campaign a generation later, starting in the 1980s, wound up in the House and Senate and at state in state positions at all levels. So I think there's definitely those kind of ebbs and flows. As I mentioned, this cycle looks different because it seems more intense in some ways. You know, just the sheer paucity of bills passed out of this Congress is a big part of that. But it is definitely cyclical.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Ron is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Ron.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Like I was telling the screener, I think you have to have your head in the sand to make believe that this president being black and the first black African-American president doesn't have something to do with this polarization.
Ron, thanks for the call. We were talking a little bit about that earlier, Jonathan Pollack. And is it a matter of race or is there more to it than that?
I think race is at the heart of a lot of it. I would contend that for some of Obama's opponents, it's not race at a conscious level. But when you're talking about the history of racism, there's so much that's below the surface of consciousness. There's so much that's just kind of ingrained with people where they go to stereotypes without really thinking about it. And I agree with the caller on that one, that I think the fact that Obama's black has a great deal to do with that. And at the same time, I think one of the reasons that Obama seems often kind of baffled by the blowback that he gets for doing things that are relatively innocuous is that he had a really unusual upbringing. You know, he was not especially close to the black side of his family, to his father and to their family. That he had an education at an elite private school in Honolulu, excellent universities for college and law school. So he was kind of insulated from some of that day-to-day racism that most African-Americans run into. Ultimately, I think that's a huge part of it, that there's a slice of the electorate that still can't quite get over the fact we elected a black president.
You know, as you listen to, if you read editorial pages, if you read columns of one kind or another, there's sort of a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth about the polarization that we see, about this gridlock. Is the period that we're in right now, is it in and of itself a bad thing?
You mean the polarization? Is the polarization
bad?
Yeah,
I mean, is gridlock bad? I mean, so we're not doing anything good. Well, we're not doing anything bad either, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one way to look at it. If you're relatively optimistic about the current state of things, if the status quo works for you, then yeah, gridlock is just fine. And in other periods of gridlock, people have said that that Wall Street, that other corporate interests in the U.S. really want gridlock to be a thing. If Congress is fighting each other, they're not actually going out and passing laws, heaven forbid. At the same time, if you look around at the United States and you look at income inequality, you look at student loan debt, you look at other solvable problems that are out there, then gridlock's extremely frustrating. That you know, you're yearning for some kind of solution. There are facts of life that are painfully evident to people once they step foot outside their houses or don't. And if Congress is too busy kind of making talking points and puffing themselves up on talk shows and stuff like that to actually get down to the business of governing, that's super frustrating.
Well, John, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for calling me up.
We appreciate it. That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. Over the weekend, we saw the first major snowstorm hit southern Wisconsin, and it caused a lot of traffic-related issues, including a 41-car pileup on I-894.
We figured it's time to get a refresher on winter driving. And here to give us tips on how to drive safely this time of year is Pam Moen. She's the Assistant Vice President of Public Affairs at AAA. Pam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, it's not officially winter yet, not until the 21st, but the weather makes us think otherwise.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I forget.
Yeah, I know. What's your most basic tip for driving safely in the winter?
Well, really the biggest thing is we need to slow down and allow extra travel time when road conditions are poor, like we saw yesterday. That is the single biggest thing, and a lot of these crashes, like we saw, can be prevented if people will just slow down and increase the following distance between you and the vehicle in front of you. Watch what's going on ahead of you, and if you've left enough room, chances are much better that you will be able to respond and react in time to some of the things that are going on ahead of you. But too often, and in most cases with the first big snowfall of the season, it takes us a while to be reminded how to drive when the conditions are poor. But the biggest thing people can do is just slow down.
Are there things we can do to our vehicles to help along with the with keeping us safe?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of key things to do with your vehicle in the winter time. The first is to check your battery. AAA gets more calls for faulty batteries in the winter time than for anything else, and a lot of people don't know that. At 0 degrees, for an example, your battery has about 1/3 less starting power than it does when temperatures are warmer. So if your battery is aging and maybe has been working during the warmer days, when we get this cold snap, it can fail. And so that's one of the things to check out ahead of time so you don't become stranded. Likewise, make sure your tires have adequate tread for winter driving. That's another big issue and can help prevent slide-offs and skidding if you have adequate tire tread. The other thing, if your windshield wipers are aging, make sure that you replace those so that your windshield doesn't streak when you're trying to clear the snow and ice while you're driving. That will make sure that you are having the best visibility possible while driving, which will help keep you safe. And then the other important thing to remember, especially in the winter time, is to keep your gas tank at least half full all of the time to avoid potential fuel line freeze-ups. And in the event that you would slide off the road or become stranded, you'll have enough fuel in your tank to run your car periodically to help stay warm.
Let's dig into some of those for a bit. So with our tire tread, how do we know if it's time to replace our tires?
Well, with all of today's technology, we still have the old standby. If you pull out a quarter and see President Washington's head, if you put the quarter into the groove of your tire tread with his head pointed down, as long as you can still see some space between the president's head and where your tire tread starts, you should have adequate tire tread to get you through the winter. However, if your tread is close to or covering up part of the president's head, then it's probably time to look at getting new tires. And I did that myself this fall just because my tires were at that point where they were getting me by fine during the warmer months, but I just feel much better having full traction on all four wheels in the wintertime.
Maybe this is just superstition on my part. It was something that my mom and my grandmother taught me is to get the juice flowing in your battery, sit and park for just a few seconds and tap the gas. Is that going to help boost that battery power that you're talking about?
Well, that is something that AAA, it's not among our recommendations, but most cars today, if you start them up, you know, I remember growing up too, when it was cold like this, we'd start the cars and let them run for a few minutes before we actually started driving. But that's really not necessary with today's vehicles. Most of them can start up and pretty much go into operation fairly quickly.
I should have mentioned my grandma drove a 1972 Buick Electra.
Well,
so
there you go.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind as I try to employ other advice she gave me.
So, yeah, things have changed a bit since
then. Well, we all like to think that we're good drivers, and of course, I'm sure many of us are, but there are other drivers on the highways, too, that we need to be careful of. What tips do you have for defensive driving?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, and I was actually out driving in the snowstorm last night, and I reminded myself of that. It's, you know, I was trying to be cautious and go slow, but then was reminded a number of times that not everyone is being as cautious as you might like them to be. But certainly there are some driving tips that can help keep you safe in a storm like we saw yesterday. The first, as we've talked about, is to just slow down and increase the following distance between you and the vehicle in front of you. That is your best advice for defensive driving. That just leaves you more time to react if a car in front of you skids out or collides with something. It will give you more time to respond and hopefully stay out of the mix. Some of the other things you can do before you start out: remove all of the snow from your entire car so that if you leave snow on your lights, it makes you less visible. If you leave it on your hood, it can blow up into your windshield. If you leave it on your roof, it can blow off and impair the visibility of the drivers behind you. So that's a really good idea, to make sure that you clear all of the snow from your car so that it doesn't impair you or the other drivers on the road with you. Also, a good idea to drive with your low beam headlights on. It helps you see as well as to be seen by other drivers. A reminder to watch also for icy surfaces on bridges and exit ramps and intersections, as those areas tend to ice up sooner than perhaps the regular roadway. Again, you want to just look farther ahead in traffic to make sure that you allow yourself the maximum time to react if something goes wrong ahead of you. Also, be mindful of trucks. I know last night when I was out, anytime a truck would pass, it would almost be a whiteout condition. And so you have to anticipate that and be able to slow down and also know that trucks take more time and space to stop than a passenger vehicle takes. So you want to be really mindful of any large vehicles or trucks on the road with you. A couple of other things. A lot of folks don't know that you shouldn't use your cruise control in rain or snowy conditions. That can actually increase your chances of skidding and losing control of the vehicle. Another reminder to folks that own a four-wheel drive vehicle: well, that can help get you out of snow better than a different vehicle. It's not going to help you stop any faster. So folks driving four-wheel drives need to drive just as slowly and be just as cautious as everyone else. That's not going to prevent you from skidding or allow you to stop if something happens in front of you.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for sharing these tips with us.
Well, you're so welcome. And it's also really important, if people haven't already done so, to make sure that they're carrying some emergency supplies in their vehicle, and always travel with your cell phone and battery charger in case you need to call for help.
And what's your website if people want to take a look?
You bet. AAA's got a lot of good driving safety information. It's simply www.AAA.com.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
That was Pam Moen, Assistant Vice President of Public Affairs at AAA.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Terry Bell recently spent time with a group of women in Wisconsin who say they honor the ancient tradition of singing at the bedsides of people who are struggling, some with living, some with dying.
Now is the only moment.
Some people call them deathbed choirs, but those who perform the service prefer to call themselves threshold singers. And we're going to meet some of them now. They belong to the National Threshold Singers chapter in Madison, and we'll let them tell you their story in their own words.
We sing for people who are seriously ill, for people who are dying, and for people who are grieving. But we don't consider ourselves entertainers. That's not what we do. We sing to heal. We're like music therapists.
We are sending you light to heal you, to hold you.
We don't sing the whole choir around a bedside. We only sing with maximum four of us, and we sing very, very softly because we don't want to intrude or overwhelm. We want to reach people at their heart level. And we really want to be just kind of floating over them.
We are sending you light to hold you in love.
Most of the music is rather soothing, but it doesn't necessarily have to be, does it? It could be something rather boisterous if that's what the situation called for, right?
We've been singing for a gentleman here with a lot of memory loss, and he couldn't verbalize anything, and we have been singing to him for months. And he usually is quite agitated and often wants the songs to end, and then we got a list of some different songs. We started singing the old-time songs, and we sang A Bicycle Built for Two, and this man, his eyes flew wide open, and he started singing with us on one of the verses, and we couldn't believe it. It was just like the room was electrified. We had finally reached him.
But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
Bicycle built for two.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah.
I had sang at my grandmother's deathbed and sat at my father's deathbed and sang to him. So I was very interested in continuing that because I really saw that it helped the spirit lift. And I felt great joy when I did it.
Celebrate.
People have different beliefs and theories behind it, but one is the idea that women throughout history have been the midwives that usher in life, and that they should be the ones at the gate out the other end to help people cross the threshold to the next life.
Celebrate your dreams and your visions
coming true.
Oh, I love this. I love doing this.
From spiritual to spirited, we've just met a few of the members of the Threshold Singers of Madison.
We'll never break if your life is what you make it.
That was Wisconsin Public Radio's Terry Bell talking with the Threshold Singers of Madison.
We're joined now by Casper Sun. She's the founder of the Threshold Singers, and she's here with a few members of the group to tell us more about their work. Casper, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, tell me why you decided to lead this group. What inspired you to do so?
I had the privilege of singing for my mother during her hospice time. She was a singer, and she just, when people asked what could they do for her, she said, "Would you please sing to me?" And she had 2 months from the time she was diagnosed, and in time people came to visit, that's what we would do. And it was just so meaningful to her and to the people who were grieving and saying goodbye to her. And right up to the end, she would sing with us, and it was very comforting and healing to her. And she actually had lung cancer. At the end, she actually started singing in sign language, so she was doing finger motions while we sang. But the experience is what planted the seed for me of combining my background as both social work and music, putting that together and doing this service for other people. And then I came across the website for the National Threshold Choir and found out there are groups all over the United States that do this. So even though I had come up with the idea on my own, other people all over were also doing this. And so the Madison organization is a part of the national organization. There's actually four choirs in the state of Wisconsin. There's one in Sturgeon Bay, one in Eau Claire, and one in Oconomowoc, and besides our own choir here in Madison. But if people are hearing this and are interested to have a threshold singing group in your community, it's a beautiful thing to do. It's a wonderful volunteer activity.
Can you talk a little bit about the emotions that you feel when you're singing at someone's deathbed?
Well, we sing both for people who aren't necessarily have a hospice diagnosis. Like actually just last week, we were singing for a woman during her chemotherapy. So sometimes we're singing mm-hmm. for people, giving them hope and encouragement. And other times we have songs of comfort and peace. When it's someone who's at the end of life, frequently the family members are present and sit near to them, and we're singing for the whole family and helping them to say goodbye. We always bring Kleenex with mm-hmm. us. Music opens hearts and causes tears, and we prepared for that. So we actually went a whole year before we offered our services of just getting ready to do this.
And, yeah. Well, you've brought along some singers, and we'd love to hear you sing us a song. Tell us a little bit about what song we're going to hear.
Okay. We thought that during this holiday time, there are just so many people who are experiencing grieving. Holidays bring that up, of people that you're missing, and other people that might be out there that could use a healing song, struggling with health issues. So this song is May Peace Be With You. It's written by Annie Gerritsen, and we'll send this out.
Sounds great. You're listening to Central Time. Our guests are the Threshold Singers of Madison, and Casper Sun is the founder of the group, singing us a song here on the Ideas Network.
May peace be with you. Peace be with you now. May peace be with you always. Peace be with you now and always. May love be with you. Love be with you now. May love be with you always. Love be with you now and always. May grace be with you. Peace be with you now and
That was beautiful. That was the Threshold Singers of Madison. And they sing to patients who are going through some difficult times. And I can see how that is quite comforting to the patients. And for those who aren't in the studio, the smile on your faces alone are enough to brighten one's day, and the beautiful rainbow scarves too. Casper, thank you so much for joining us today on Central Time.
Thank you for having us.
That was Casper Sun. She's the founder of the Threshold Singers of Madison.